Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. Another Monday night. Okay, tonight's class, I'd like to thank Gail Vexler, as always, for putting together our sheet. Nothing would be done without Gail around here, so thank you very much. And tonight, a special treat. Gail also helped provide some of our little nosh in the back, and it's very much appreciated for that. Thank you very much, Gail. Okay, tonight's topic, loving the Jewish people and controlling our anger. Now, these are actually two separate topics in the curriculum, if you were to look through them, but I thought they go very well together. I think we would all agree on a simple level, just to begin, if we never got angry at anybody, we would find it very easy to love them. Like, that would be really similar. It's not that I don't love my fellow Jews, because they did something to deserve whatever animosity that I might have towards them. But if we can work simultaneously on the positive aspect, on the element of why, how, the aspect of loving our fellow Jews, simultaneous to working on controlling our anger, dealing with that which gets us irritated and upset, and how to handle that, as a package, we probably will be much better at this idea of the ahavta l'reicha kamocha, loving our fellow Jew, and dealing with some of our more negative emotions. So let's begin learning a little bit about this. We'll tackle them one at a time, and see what we can learn. V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. By far, I would say, one of the most popular, well-known, famous, if you will, verses in all of Torah, love your neighbor like yourself. Now, that's actually a poor translation, even though that's the common translation, love your neighbor like yourself. Why is that a poor translation? Which word there is inaccurate? Neighbor, that's right, neighbor. What is l're'acha? It's a friend. Literally, you would translate as a friend. V'ahavta l're'acha, you would think the most famous verse in all of Torah would be translated accurately, right? It's not. V'ahavta l're'acha kamocha means love your friend, he who is a re'a. Reim ha'ahuvim, the beloved friends, is the bracha, the blessing that we make at Sheva Brachas when a couple gets married. It means a beloved, a friend. Love your friend like yourself. Now, Rabbi Akiva has taken this verse and made it even more famous, because Rabbi Akiva, the great Talmudic sage, added a phrase to this, and when he said, Zeh klal gadol batorah, which means, this is the great principle of the Torah. Zeh klal gadol. Now, Rabbi Akiva, the great sage, really all he did was he quoted a verse, and then he added a commentary to it. The verse is not his. The verse actually comes from God Himself. That's the Torah's verse. The Torah says, V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. Rabbi Akiva comes along and adds, Zeh klal gadol batorah. This is the great principle of Torah. Now, that's an interesting thing. When a sage would come, one of the Tanoim, one of the sages of the Talmud would come, and in essence just quote a verse, and then add something to it. So all the verses are important. All the verses, all the mitzvahs that we have are significant. And he adds, this is a great principle of the Torah. What do we take? There are actually several different things, several different aspects in which we find the Talmud creating principles. One of the more famous ones is at the end of the tractate Makos, where the Gemara says, how many mitzvahs are there in the Torah? The Gemara, this is actually the source. All of you know the answer to this question. How many mitzvahs are there? 613. There's only one place in all of, I believe it's only one, in all of Torah where the Gemara actually tells us the tradition that we have for that number. There are actually many more commandments than 613. I mean, you all know there are like thousands of laws just within Shabbos itself. So there are tons and tons and tons of laws, but we have this tradition that there are 613 principal mitzvot, and then many subcategories of each of those. What's the source of the 613? Anyone know? The Gemara has a very interesting source for the 613. The pasuk says, Torah tziva lanu Moshe. Torah tziva lanu Moshe. The Torah was taught to us by Moshe. The gematria, the numerical equivalent of the word Torah. Tav is 400. Vav is 6. Resh is 200. Hey is 5. Gives you? Correct. I was hoping somebody would say that. 611. So the Gemara says, Torah tziva lanu Moshe. The Torah was taught to us by Moshe. So you see, 613 mitzvahs in the Torah, right? So yeah, the Gemara was pretty quick. The Gemara picked up on that one also. The Gemara says, not so fast. The Gemara says, it's only 611. The Gemara says, I know. Two of them were taught to us by God Himself. That's right. The Ten Commandments, Aseret HaDibros, the first of the two, if you read the actual text of the Aseret HaDibros, the language of the first two, I think we spoke about this recently. Anochi Hashem Elokecha. I am Hashem, your God. Lo yelecha elohim achim. Don't have any other gods on my face, upon me. And then the next eight are all spoken by Moshe, which the sages derive. The first two were taught to the Jewish people as a whole by God Himself. The other eight came through Moshe. So the Gemara says that's our source for 613. 611 came through Moshe. Two came through God Himself. That's our magic number of 613. And then there are various commentators who try to figure out what exactly those 613 are, which ones are categorized as primary, which ones are subcategories, but either way that is. Right after that, the Gemara then says, quotes three different prophets who, through the verses of their in the prophets, categorized and said, you can condense all of Torah down to 11. All of Torah, you can put 11 principles. And the Gemara goes through, what are the 11 principles that define all? And then the Gemara says, one of the later prophets came and he condensed all of Torah down to 5. Then there was another one of the prophets condensed it down to 3. And finally the Gemara says, Vochavokuk, the last of the prophets, condensed all of Torah down to one principle. One principle will define everything you need to know, and that is? Nope. That was a trick question, because that's a class we're learning, so you would have thought that was it, but it's actually not. It is Tzadik ve'emunoso yichya. A righteous person lives in emuna. Tzadik ve'emunoso, he lives with faith. A Jew lives with faith. That is the principle. So we have one principle between man and God that the Gemara records, and one principle between man and his fellow man. And that is the statement of Rabbi Akiva. If you want to know, condense all of Torah down to one spiritual between man and between God. You know what that is? Live with emunah. Live with faith. Whatever you do, know that you are doing it to develop your sense that there is a God in the world. I could say that like it's easy, but we all know that that's really hard to live one's life that way. That literally every moment of one's day, every action that one takes, every mitzvah that one fulfills, I'm doing that because I'm living with faith. That is the principle, says the Gemara, of all man-God interactions. And man-to-man interactions, that is every single time the Torah tells you anything about an interpersonal relationship, it's in order to achieve this principle of ve'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, love your fellow man like yourself. The purpose of these principles is to give us, you know, sometimes they say the English phrase, you lose the trees from the forest from the trees. You get so caught up in all the details, you miss the picture. There's something going on over here. Except you're so distracted by all the little things, you don't stop and scale back and see, what's this about? So we see there are principles. Every once in a while the Gemara says, I know we're so busy with details. We're so busy on Pesach making sure you have this type of grape juice or that type of wine and drink this amount and this time and this amount. You can get crazed with the details. And then at the end of the night you say, wait a minute, what was this about? I forgot to relive what I'm really supposed to do. I was so busy with the details. So you have to do both. You have to do all the details and you got to know what you're doing. So the Gemara says, Jewish life is very detail-oriented. We have a lot of details, a lot of things to be busy with. Every once in a while, the Gemara says, scale back and remember what you're doing. In your interpersonal relationships, v'yahavta l'reicha kamocha. Your man-God relationships, tzadik be'emunaso yichya. You're living with emunah, you're living with faith, you're living with an understanding that there is such a God. Okay, so we have this principle, we have to reach, which means everything we do in interpersonal relationships, Rabbi Akiva teaches us, is about that pasuk. That's not just a pasuk, meaning to say as follows, we have a lot of interpersonal mitzvahs in the Torah. So Rabbi Akiva is coming to teach us, this one phrase is in bold. This one phrase is not just another, don't take a loan out with interest, or don't give a loan in interest, and love your... It's not just another mitzvah. This is the mitzvah. Love your fellow man like yourself. Very beautiful in theory. It is very beautiful in theory. I think we all would agree it would be really nice that we should all love each other. In theory, right? In theory, you agree to me or not even in theory? Yeah, I agree. In theory, nice. But the reality is, in practice, it's not so simple. And I'll put that in a couple of, two different contexts of like why this is not so simple in practice. Number one is even from a halachic perspective, when we say love your fellow like yourself. You know, there's a very famous case, which I generally try not to say because maybe you haven't heard of it, and then I make you feel bad because I said it was famous. But there's a case that the Gemara discusses, which is oft quoted, is a better way of saying it, which is, if you're walking in a desert with your friend, and you only have one cup of water, and it's yours, you packed enough water and he did it, or he already drank his and you have enough. Now one cup, and you know that your destination is X amount of miles ahead of you. And if you drink this cup of water, you'll make it, and he's going to die. If you give it to him, he'll live, and you'll die. And if you split it, you both die. What do you do? That's right, you drink the water. You drink the water. Ah, you should love your friend like yourself. What's the answer? Not more than me. The big I comes first. That's right. You want to know who teaches us that principle? Do you know which sage teaches us that if you have one cup of water and if you drink it, you're going to watch your friend die? And the halacha says, drink up every last drop. Who teaches us that? Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, who says, V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, is the principle that guides everything that we do. Rabbi Akiva, who says that's not just another mitzvah, it's the mitzvah of all interpersonal relationships, love your neighbor like yourself, is the same person who tells us, love him like yourself. But you never give up your own life. You come first. Chayecha kodmin. Your life comes first. So we have a sort of halachic parameter to like, well, what then is defined as loving my neighbor like myself? I know what it's not. It's not going beyond what I would do for myself because I'm not allowed to. My life does, in fact, come first. Yeah?
What if it's your child?
Same thing.
You don't let the child
live? How could you die? I know. I mean, it's all theory. I'm sorry. I'm not saying when practice what would happen in that scenario. I imagine in that scenario, most parents would give their water to their child. I'm not saying that that's what they're supposed to do. I'm saying your life comes first. In practice, I don't think the halacha would distinguish in that point that you know that. But that's the same emotional difficulty as watching your friend die while you drink up the water. I mean, obviously different watching your child die, but again, I would say in practice, probably most parents would give the water to their kid. But I don't know that you're certainly not obligated to do that. I want to bring in that principle simply to establish Rabbi Akiva himself. We have the idea of loving your neighbor like yourself. That's not that, and that's the pasuk in the Torah. Rabbi Akiva understands that as a guiding principle. And at the same time, Rabbi Akiva tells us, but when it's your life versus someone else's life, your life does indeed come first with the possibility that would change for a child. I don't get how things, but these are all in theory. You should just know, we were discussing a week or two ago some of the very difficult suffering questions. So there, we mentioned a lot of the Holocaust questions. There was a question that recently came up in the yeshiva. We're preparing a certain topic about this issue. There was a case of a group of boys that were taken by the Nazis out to be killed. 40, 50 boys, as they did regularly. And a father of one of the boys, there was a rav, a big rav in the camp. And he came over to the Rav and he said, I have the ability to bribe one of the guards to get my son out. I have still, you know, as they sewed into their clothing, I have the means to get my son out. But if I do that, the guard's going to pull a different kid out to take his place. Am I allowed to do that? I mean, you want to know about the Jewish people, the heart and soul of the Jewish people. The Jewish people ask that question. Am I allowed to bribe the guard to save my son, but I know that he's going to take someone else's son in his stead? And the Rav looked at him and just cried. And he said, I see from your answer I'm not. And he didn't. He didn't. Because you can't. Because how can I save my son and kill somebody else's son? I mean, these are, so I say it's all in theory, and unfortunately Jewish history has proven us these questions are not necessarily only theoretical, but the halacha which guides us as far as how we handle these situations, we have got these guiding. I'm getting way off topic. But I get off topic because we are a strong people. We are a strong people, we are an inspiring people, and we are guided by the principles of how do we handle ourselves in the most trying, difficult, barbaric times, and that is with dignity, and we follow our guidelines, and that's what we've done, that's why we are here where we are today, and God willing that we should be out of this exile shortly, and not have to know from such questions being asked under such difficult situations. Okay. Regroup. So the other. So we have one difficulty in halacha: is you have to love your neighbor like yourself. You have to understand the parameters. Number two is when we deal with halacha. You know, Pesach is around the corner. I don't mean to scare you, but Pesach is around the corner. So we know that when we deal with halacha, it's detail-oriented. This amount of matzah in this amount of time. This is how you bake your matzah. This amount of grape juice. This is how you drink it. Where you drink it. So if I were to have an important mitzvah, I would think it will be similarly regimented. It will be with guidelines. If I do that for my other mitzvahs, if I have such an important mitzvah of love your fellow like yourself, there should be some explanation, some detail. How do I do that? It's nice to say, just love everybody. What does it look like if I have fulfilled this mitzvah? Which I think is the greatest way to ask the question. I think being that this is a mitzvah that we grow up from preschool with singing songs about, V'ahavta l'reacha kamoch, and Uncle Moshe has made as famous can be, well, what does it look like? What does it look like if I have succeeded in loving my friend like myself? What does it look like if I failed? When do I know that I need to work on this? Or is it just some nice theoretical idea that we like to sing songs about that Jews should love each other? So this mitzvah, like all others, should come along with some guiding principles. The theory of it, the sages describe the idea that if a person is cutting a vegetable with a knife and he accidentally splits his finger, so now he's got a knife in one hand and he's got a bloody finger on the other hand. So it would be completely irrational for this hand, which is now bleeding, to say, I can't believe it, and grab the knife and then split the other hand. Like, that doesn't make any, like, that would be totally absurd. So say the sages, that's the Jewish people. That's literally the Jewish people are two hands of the same body. We happen to be more physically separated than that, but in the theory of this mitzvah is, you're really all one. You're really all one. We are all one. And as absurd as it is for the left hand to strike at the right hand for having cut it by accident, is the same absurdity that we have as Jews when we look at each other and the infighting that we do, and the animosity, and the this and the that. That it's the same absurdity, except we have to get ourselves out of that place to be able to get beyond that. Okay, so what is it? What is it not? So what we started with, what it's not, is neglecting or nullifying yourself. That's for sure what this mitzvah does not require of us. And that comes from the principle that we mentioned of chayecha kodmin, of your life comes first. If it comes down to it, push comes to shove, you come first. Let's take a look at Hillel's formation. Hillel's formulation of this can be found on page 2. The Gemara records, this is also an oft-quoted Gemara that I'm sure many of you are familiar with, and you'll pick up what I hope is a small nuanced but significant difference. The number 2 on page 2, it's actually the second number 2 on the page, from the Gemara in Maseches Shabbos, 31a, a story about a Gentile who came before Shammai. Shammai and Hillel were two colleagues who have various disputes. Their schools, both of them had various disputes in the Gemara. So this non-Jew comes before Shammai and says, I will convert if you teach me the entire Torah while I stand on one leg. Anyone ever hear this Gemara before? I had a group of, we have a group of schools, non-Jewish schools who come here regularly during the year. They take their religions class and I speak with them. They come to the main shul. So we had Mount Pisgah Christian Academy came just 2 weeks ago. We've had various other, Marist came the other year, in 2 weeks we're having from, not Paideia, one of the other schools. They come. They have one of their classes is a religion class, and then they actually go on a field trip throughout the week. They go to all the various different houses of worship, and somehow Beth Jacob ended up on their Jewish stop. So they come, and I have a chance to answer up all their questions. And I've learned over the years, instead of my giving a presentation, which just bores them, all the kids to sleep, it's just a question-answer session. I just stand up there, and I say, I go. And they just ask all the questions that they have. So they ask one question about something, and I said, okay, let me just quickly give you an answer while I stand on one foot. Which none of you would have blinked if I would have said that, because what does that mean if I say that? I'm going to give you a quick, short answer just while I stand on one foot. What's the reference? It's the reference of this piece of the Gemara. Everybody's heard of the Gentile who came to Hillel and asked him and Shammai to teach him the entire Torah. They stand on one foot. It's a cultural reference. So I gave him my quick answer, and then the teacher raised his hand and said, can you please explain to my students what you meant when you said, while I stand on one foot? I said, what do you mean? I'm just, like, what's there to explain? He said, they've never heard of that before. Oh, interesting. That's like that wheel. So I explained to them. I didn't mean like, they were like looking at me funny, like, are you going to stand there on like one foot while you talk to us? Like, no, it's just a phrase. And I explained to them this this piece of the Talmud. But in any case, so what does it mean? So what does it mean when the Gentile comes before the Shammai and says, I'll convert, but only if you teach me the entire Torah while I stand on one foot? Now, many of the commentators learned that he was not being a smart aleck. He was not trying to poke fun. He just wanted to give me the principle. Can you the condensed version while I stand on one foot? And Shammai had nothing of it. Shammai said, pushed him aside, said, I'm not interested. So he goes to the sage Hillel, and he says to Hillel, convert me, but only on condition that you can teach me the entire Torah while I stand on one foot. And Hillel answers, you have it in front of you. Mada alecha sni lechavercha lo sa'ad. That which is hateful to you, do not do to your friend. If you don't like it, don't do it to anybody else. Says the great sage Hillel, this is the entire Torah. Now go and learn. That's what he says, Hillel. If you don't like it, don't do it to your friend. That's the entire Torah encapsulated in one brief statement. The rest is commentary. Go and learn. That's Hillel's response. So what's of note in Hillel's response? He gives the opposite side of the question. The Torah says it in the positive. Ahavta l'reacha kamocha. Love your neighbor like you love yourself. And Hillel formulates it as, don't do to your friend that which you don't like. We'll talk about that in a moment. But in essence, it's the same idea. It's just the opposite side of the coin. With the same, just like Rabbi Akiva said, Zeklal Gadol Batorah, this is the principle of all of Torah. Love your neighbor like yourself. Everything that we do is only towards that. Hillel basically phrased that just the opposite. He says to a non-Jew, you want to know Torah? I'll tell you all of Torah. All you need to know, if you don't like it, don't do it to your... It's fascinating because like we would say that to like a four-year-old. Like, you wouldn't like that if somebody did that to you now, would you? That's really how we talk, right? Hillel says, that's the entire Torah. That's, I don't mean to call you like four-year-olds, but like, that's the entire Torah. If you don't like it, don't do it to someone else. Everything else is commentary. Go and learn. That's what Hillel has to say. So let's understand how this is fulfilled. These two sides of the coin. So what I'd like to share with you tonight is three approaches that our commentators have given us in a practical way to understand what exactly this means. Yeah. Yeah, okay, so we're not going to talk about that tonight. So what Sheila's pointing out is that there's an assumption made in the statement. Love your friend like yourself. The assumption that's made is that you love yourself. I can't love my neighbor, my friend, like I love myself if I don't already love myself. So that is a clear assumption. That's not the focus we're going to be talking about tonight, but that many of the more recent Ba'alei Musar, those involved in their own self-worth, self-respect, character development, point that out as what's the source for loving yourself? Where do you find that the Torah demands of you positive, healthy self-esteem, to think of yourself in a good, positive way, and to love yourself? Because if I have to love my neighbor like myself, the assumption there is that you actually do indeed love yourself. And that is correct. That is the starting point. And then the Torah is assuming that and now saying, now you have to transfer that to everybody else in your world as well. But that's 100% that's correct. Okay, so let's talk, as I mentioned, three approaches on a more practical way. So what does it look like to fulfill this mitzvah? What does it look like to love one's friend like oneself? The first approach is on page 4, source number 3. This comes from a Maharsha. The Maharsha is one of the classic commentators in the Gemara. It's in the middle of your page. He's printed, his commentary is printed in the back of all of the Gemaras that are printed since the 15, 1600s. You'll find his commentary. And he writes as follows. Whatever is hateful to you, this is commenting on the statement of Hillel. Hillel said, if you don't like it, don't do it to your friend. That's all of Torah. Says the Maharsha, whatever is hateful to you, this refers to that which is written in the Torah, you shall love your fellow as you love yourself. Now we can ask why Hillel altered the mitzvah by phrasing it in the negative. That's the question that we ask. The Torah phrases it in the positive, love your friend like yourself, and Hillel reverses it and says, don't do to your friend that which you don't want to. Says the Maharsha, the answer to that, why did Hillel reverse it, is that the mitzvah itself is a type of prohibition just like the other mitzvot in this verse. Now to understand what he's saying, I'm going to ask you to flip back to the very first page. Let's take a look at the verse as a whole entity. It's actually on page 2. First page of your sources. The very first source on the top of the page on page 2. Pasuk in Vayikra that we've been speaking about. Let's read it as a whole. Lo sikom velo sitor. Do not take revenge. Do not bear a grudge against the members of your people. And you shall love your fellow as yourself. Ani Hashem, I am God. So that there are actually three mitzvahs listed in the very same pasuk. Number one, don't take revenge. Number two, don't bear a grudge. Number three, love your neighbor like yourself. So the Maharsha points out, that's a note. In the midst of a list of prohibitions, don't take revenge, don't bear a grudge, then you have the commandment of love your neighbor like yourself. Says the Maharsha, flipping back to number 4, that's page 4, that's actually a flow. They're all prohibitions. How do you love your neighbor like yourself? How do you love your friend like yourself? Don't do to him all the things that the Torah says as the prohibitions of don't do to your friend, all of these following things. Be a nice guy. That's how you love your neighbor, is refrain from doing things to him that he won't like. So that we ask, why did Hillel reverse it? He's explaining it to you. You want to know what it looks like to love your neighbor like yourself? Don't do to him things that you wouldn't want done to yourself. Reading it in his own language. And you shall love your fellow as you love yourself is not an imperative to bestow an equal amount of goodness upon another, which we know from the legal principle of Chayefa Kodmin, that your life comes first, which is what the case of the water. So in other words, how is the Maharsha, approach number one, how do you fulfill V'ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha? It's not an active doing things for him, because that's like, it's impossible. How could I possibly love someone the way I love myself? It's asking too much of me. What is it asking of me? Not to do something that you wouldn't want done to yourself. That's his approach. So that Hillel reverses it in a way of describing that. So the Torah tells you I want you to love. How do you love? Not to do something that he doesn't like. So if we would put this into a context of a relationship, which is always a good way to start, if you think about whether as a child to a parent, or as a spouse, or even at work, so you say, I want everybody in the family to love each other. So one way to do that is, there are positive ways to do that, but the more basic way, before you get to the positive, how do you show that there's going to be love and harmony in this home? We don't do things to each other that drive each other crazy. That's a more basic level. This we've mentioned a couple of times also. When you have, there are some mitzvahs which are positives and some which are prohibitions. The prohibitions are, you don't do things which offend me. You can actively do things to show love. You can go out and buy a nice card. You can buy flowers. You can take me out to dinner. But you can't skip the first step. The first step is, don't do things that I don't like. If I think I've said this example before, but I'll repeat it here in case I didn't. If you were to have a husband who comes home, I'm sure I said this in one class, it's been a couple years ago already, and he says, I really appreciate it if you're not on the phone when I come home. Just if you're on the phone, if you could please just hang up and give me 5 minutes, it really means a lot to me. And she says, okay, fine, so it's fine. And he comes home the next day, she's on the phone, she doesn't get off the phone, and while she's on the phone, she puts down this beautiful dish that she's prepared. Steaming hot steak, potatoes, like all his favorite. No broccoli, it's all good. So he says, you know, I asked you not to be on the phone, and she says, She says, no, really, it's important to me. She says, I gave you dinner. So he looks at her quizzically, and is like, all right. Comes over the next day, and same thing. He walks in the door, and she's on the phone, and she puts down, while she's on the phone, an exquisitely prepared dinner that's something else beautiful. It's perfect. It's steamed salmon, all his favorite things. And he says, I really appreciate it if you'd be off the phone. She says, I made you the salmon. So you say, so what's going on over here? You break it down. So she's doing active things that she likes, but what's she violating? The things that he doesn't like. How, at the end of the day, will this relationship be enhanced or detracted by this exchange? So it's clear. I mean, this is what we talk about. I mean, in our own lives, it's hard to actually, if we're in the middle of this, we do this all the time. It's hard to extract ourselves and see how ridiculous it is. But as you're just listening to me, there's no question what this is silliness. Because if you can't get past don't do the things I don't like, the active doing things I like always falls flat. It's meaningless. It doesn't accomplish anything. So says the Maharsha, you know what Hillel was telling us? You know how you fulfill v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha? Let me tell you where to start. You want to love your neighbor like yourself? Don't drive your car in his grass. Like, forget about taking him out to lunch or paying his mortgage for him. We're not worried about those things. You want to love your friend like yourself? Don't do the things he doesn't like. That's the basis of the relationship. Everything positive beyond that is the next level. But the first tier is simply stay away from that. Okay, that's number one. Number two is the opinion of the Rambam and of the Chinuch. The Rambam and the Chinuch, two of our classic commentators, Maimonides lived in the 12th century, and the Chinuch a little bit after that, describe some actual positive things that a person can do in a way that would be a fulfillment of this. If we want to take a look at the words of the Chinuch, we could do that on page 3. It's number 5 on page 3. The elements in this mitzvah follow the general principle that one should treat another person in the way that he would treat himself. Now he's going to say it though in a positive way, not just not doing something that he doesn't like, but in the positive, which is protecting his property, preventing him from being harmed, speaking only well of him, respecting him, and certainly not glorifying oneself at his expense. So he gives us, you want to know how you love somebody? So you'd love him by doing the things to him that you would do for yourself in a positive way. You protect his property, not just don't drive on his property. Actually go out of your way to protect it. Prevent him from being harmed. Speak only well of him. Respect him. And don't glorify yourself at his expense. The Rambam writes something very, very similar. We don't have to read that inside. It's basically the same idea, which is another approach of actively going out and doing things that would show that kind of love, that type of care or concern. The third approach that I want to share with you, which is a personal favorite of mine that I've had a chance to, and I remember sharing this many, many years ago, even in yeshiva, amongst a chabur that I had given. It's such a powerful idea from the Ramban. The Ramban, Nachmanides, also a 12th century sage, writes as follows. When he discusses this mitzvah, he says, at the end of the day, he says, it's nearly impossible. How do you really love somebody like yourself? It's just a difficult thing to ask. And he says the following. He says, what the mitzvah demands of us is to want good things for your friends. Now think about this. This is how Rav Dessler, who lived in our century just about 50, 60 years ago, understood what he meant. Want good things for your friends. In life, we all identify ourselves in a certain way. There are certain things in the community that we do and that we like to think of ourselves as, this is my thing. I'm the one who arranges meals when, I don't know, someone has a baby. I'm the one who takes care of a shiva. I'm the one who helps make a minyan in this scenario. I'm the one who does this, that, or the other. And in our own little circles, we find things that we do. And what happens often is, I wish others well. I wish them well financially. I wish them well emotionally. I wish them well in their families. Just not as well as me. Or just not in this area, because that's my thing. And V'ahavt l'recha kamocha says, it's a good thing if all people are doing more good things. And that part of us that says, yeah, sure, I'm happy if everybody does well, just not as well as me. Or just that they shouldn't have this one thing so that I can be the only one to do it. That's where the mitzvah demands from us an ability to get outside of ourselves. An ability to say, it's not just about me. I actually wish for everyone else to have what I wish for myself. And that is a very sophisticated understanding that whatever it is that you want for yourself, whatever that you hope for, whatever you yearn for, that's the thing that you want for everyone else too. And you're willing to pray for them and to do whatever it takes for them to get it also, and not to be in that mode of, yeah, I want this, but there should be some gap between me and everybody else, that I want everybody else to be as good at whatever it is that I'm doing as everybody else. Just as an example, so you'd have, Chazan and Schultz, have people daven for the Amun. So everybody who we ask to daven for the Amun, they want to be the best. And if you would ask them when they're listening to the next guy, so like, what are they hoping for? No, they don't want them to mess up. No, I want them to be good. Just not as good as me, you know? That's what's going through the mind of most people in that very simple scenario. When you're at work and someone's making a presentation, so they're on your team, so of course you want them to be good, just not as good as you. That's a very natural thought process. And V'ahavta l'recha kamocha says, I really want everybody to be as good. And you spoke about children. That's the thing, like, it's easier for us to actually wish for children to be better than us. That's where you will actually find that, where parents will want their children to be better than them. I actually want my children. It's very rare where you find a parent who wishes their child to be successful financially, just not as much as me. That I haven't seen so much. I want them to be more than me. I want them to do better, to be more successful, to accomplish more. If you have to, I want this from everyone. I want everyone to be as successful as I can be in every single way. And that is how the Ramban understands what this mitzvah requires of us. So we have three approaches. Number one is simply a negative approach. Don't do things that nobody else, that you wouldn't like. If you don't like it, they don't like it either. That's what it means. That's what it looks like to fulfill this. Or in a positive sense, to actually look out for their benefit. Or the Ramban's way is it's a mental state. It's a mental state of, I want for everyone around me to be as successful in whatever it is that I want for myself, I want for them as well. And we use our own experiences for this. Whatever it is, you know, what you actually like, what you actually want, and what you don't want, we use those experiences to be able to figure that out. There are some interesting Talmudic applications of this concept, which I briefly share with you. Some of you pointed out already on the notes on the first page, you have marriage and death penalty, the total random that they ended up next to each other. But it happens to be that the Gemara uses both of those references for applications of this concept. There's a situation, the Gemara talks about in marriage, whether or not a young husband is permitted to become, in the word English word is engaged, but does kiddushin. He actually gives his intended kala a ring, and he says, Aram, the kiddushin that we do under the chuppah, is he allowed to do so without ever having seen her? Say so they are speaking over email, they've never actually spoken, they talk over the phone, they decide they want to get married, they live in two different cities, and he sends an agent He gives the ring to a buddy of his who's traveling to the town that she's in. Please, on behalf of me, give her this ring. Halachically, that works. You can use an agent to deliver the ring. But he's never seen her. So the Gemara establishes a prohibition from doing so. You're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to marry a girl, not fully, this is just the Kiddushin, this is the before the Chuppah stage. You're not even allowed to do the Kiddushin stage of giving a ring without ever having seen her. Why? Gemara says, because you might not find her attractive, and then you're going to want to divorce her.
That was a common, I don't know if it's common, but it was done a lot in
the So the Talmud records a prohibition, because you might not find her attractive, you'll then want to divorce her, and that is a violation of V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. How could you do that to someone? You get her hopes up. She thinks she's getting married. And then you open up the door. It's like a first date. Open it. She thinks she's married already. Opens up the first door. And I'm like, oh, this isn't for me. That's a violation of V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. So the Gemara says, we are prohibiting that simply because that isn't, the Torah says, V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. And therefore, we have to act in ways that we, in our everyday life, find applications of what would this look like. V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. Meaning what? Yeah, but she's stuck because in Jewish law she can't initiate the divorce. So not only can she not initiate the divorce, but the Gemara has the principle that even if she doesn't like the way that he looks, but she'd rather be married to a guy who looks like that than not be married. I don't know, we'll just leave it there. In the times of the Gemara, you're working with, and in the times of the Gemara, you're working with the concept of having multiple wives. You were living in a society where a woman who wasn't married had no chances. It wasn't like today. She couldn't make it. She wasn't a feasible thing. So in an environment where that was, it was a much preferable to her to marry. But anyway, that's not our point of our discussion tonight. And I know I'm never going to get out of here. I know I was just joking. I made up the whole thing. So the Gemara has another series of applications. The Gemara works through Masechet Sanhedrin. There are four capital punishments in Jewish law. Various capital crimes that a person can commit, violating Shabbos, various other things which we don't need to get into, which brings about murder, adultery, which bring about a capital punishment. There are four types of capital punishment. Stila is stoning, strafa is having molten lead poured down one's throat, strangulation, and chenek. So the Gemara, how do you do these things? How do you fulfill the strafa, which is literally burning? So the Gemara suggests, how do we know what burning is? Maybe burning is burning a person alive. So the Gemara says, no, that's not what it is. It's for sure, it's molten lead poured down the throat, which is an instantaneous death. The Gemara says, how do you know that's what it is? The language of the Torah is yistareif. It should be burned. So maybe that's what it means. So the Gemara says, how do we know that the way that you fulfill that type of capital crime, which, as you know, the Gemara says, if once in 70 years, Beis Din actually implemented any one of the capital punishments, it was considered a bloodthirsty, murderous court. Very rare occurrences. But we need to learn what's required of it. How do we know that the way that it's fulfilled is with hot molten lead poured down the throat, which is an immediate death, and not being burnt alive? V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, the Gemara quotes. Which type of death, if one needed to have such a death administered to them, would you go with the immediate death, or would you go with being burnt alive? There's no question. So how does the Gemara know which way to do it? V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. You have to love your neighbor like yourself, dictates for us an understanding of what it is that and how we figure out the laws of the Torah. Because it's a practical, the Gemara uses that in various, almost all four of the capital crimes, the way that the Gemara understands the way that it's administered, always chooses the quickest, most painless death, and this is talking about a person who had violated some serious prohibitions to get themselves in this position in the first place. Yet, when we come to the application, how do we do it? We use the principle called V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha to choose an understanding of the best, painless, easiest, most dignified death possible, because even for such a person, the Ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha requires us to find that. So those are just places and applications which you actually find this idea. Are there limitations on loving your fellow Jew? Are there Jews who we are not required to love? So the answer to that is yes. If you flip to page 6, you will find a verse from the Psalms. Hating those who hate God. Pasuk in Tehillim, Halom istanecha, Hashem esna, shall I not hate those who hate you, O God? And shall I not agitate against those who deny your providence? As David HaMelech says in Sefer Tehillim, what do we do with people who are anti-God? Shall we not hate such people? The Gemara says, in fact, somebody who is an immoral, evil person, you are permitted to hate such a person. The Torah states, if you see your enemy's donkey struggling under its burden, a pasuk we read just a few weeks ago, so you have an obligation to help out the donkey, and the Torah says it's son acha, it's a person who you hate, your enemy, it's his donkey. So the Gemara says, that's not referring to a non-Jew, it's not some Cossack donkey riding through town that you have an obligation. We're talking about it in a Jewish town, it's a Jewish person. So how can he be considered your enemy, says the Gemara? But it is permitted to hate a fellow Jew, for we know that the Torah says, you shall not hate your brother in your... how can it be permitted to hate? The Torah says, you shall not hate your brother in your heart. Rather, the verse must be speaking about someone whom you saw do an immoral act, and that is a Jew you are permitted to hate. Meaning you cannot prosecute him, because you are a single witness, but you know that he is an evil person who has violated prohibitions in the Torah. He is the Jew that you're permitted to hate. The very next source, Jews are commanded to love one another in a generous way, lest we think that this applies to everyone. The verse includes the word fellow, v'ahavta l'reyacha. It has to be your friend, meaning someone who, like you, has accepted the responsibility for the commandments and loves mitzvahs as you do. However, if someone is a sinner, you are not commanded to love him. Rather, we are commanded to hate him. Now, this creates all sorts of issues in the world in which we live, but we live in a very unique point in time, and this is a very important point which must be made on both sides of the equation. And we've stated many times in the series, particularly in the historical aspects of the series over the last 2 years, that we are living in one of the only times in history where the overwhelming majority of Jews who identify as Jews are not observant. This is a new phenomena starting from the 1700s. Jews were the Jews. Either you were observant or you left the fold. You didn't identify as a Jew, as a non-observant Jew. Yes, this is indeed a bad century for every century has been a bad century for the Jews. 100%. You know, when you think about I'll leave that alone. Yes. throughout our history, you had the Jews, and the Jews were observant Jews, and then there always were Jews who were non-observant. That's nothing new, but the non-observant Jews didn't identify as a non-observant Jew. They left the fold and did whatever they wanted with their lives. With the advent of the Reform and then later the Conservative movement, now we have the overwhelming majority of identified Jews in the world who are not observant. Which is a rather new phenomenon, and it has changed the grace. So when the Gemara talks about what we just quoted, that a Jew who is not in the fold, so to speak, we're talking about a Jew who is fully educated, well aware of everything, and has openly rejected all of the laws and has rebelled against God and against his people. That's who the Gemara is referring to. That's not today's world that we live in. That overwhelming majority of Jews, so they're not educated in traditional Jew. They don't know what it is that they've rejected. So you can't say about somebody that they've rejected God and rejected Torah when they don't necessarily know the depths of God and of Torah. And so we have this dynamic which exists in many areas of halacha where the Gemara talks about a non-observant Jew in a certain light. And the light that they're talking about him is in the light of someone who knows and who says, I don't care, I don't believe. Which is not the light of today's world, which is a light of either apathy or lack of knowledge. It's a different world, and even the knowledge that's out there in all worlds is different. So we live in a very, the traditional sources, most of the times in these areas, are talking about a day and an age and a society that's very different from the one that we live in today. But, therefore, you'll find sources where your one is not obligated to love every Jew, and you know, overwhelming majority of the situations in today's day and age is we would not say that. You come across any Jew today, as I'm sure all of you know, all of us have family, I would imagine, in this room, that would not identify Orthodox. And these statements of, well, you have a mitzvah to hate them, certainly does not apply in today. It's a different world. It's an entirely different world that we live in. Today I would not in any way hesitant to say just the opposite. We have the obligation in today's day and age to love absolutely every single Jew, because there's a lot of teaching to be done. There's a lot of authentic Judaism to be taught out in the world, and the only way that that's going to be done is through love. It's not going to be done in any other manner other than teaching, embracing, and showing what the beauty of our heritage and what our religion teaches in a traditional 3,328-year-old version. But it is important to be aware within the conversation of Yahavta L'Recha Kamocha. I'm running out of time for anger. Don't be angry at me if we don't get to everything that we wanted to get to. As far as that goes. One Hasidic thought on this, which will conclude this part of the discussion. If you look at page 7, Shner Zalman of Liadi, who was one of the founders of Chabad, which you'll find not surprising at all when we read this passage. So he says as follows: regarding that which is stated in the Talmud, that is a mitzvah to hate someone who sins. So he's dealing with the issue that we're dealing with, but he's dealing with this several hundred years ago. How do you relate to a sinner? So the Talmud, the verse in the Psalms is pretty clear. You relate to a sinner as a sinner. So says the Rav Shner Zalman of Liadi, the Baal HaTanya, the first Chabad Rebbe, this refers to someone who is your equal in learning and deeds and whom you have properly rebuked. As we mentioned, that's somebody who knows, somebody who's aware, who has been pointed out his behavior and has rejected your rebuke, and he goes off in his way. But if he does not fit this description, meaning he is not learned, he is not your equal in deeds, then Hillel the elder has taught us to be like the disciples of Aharon, loving peace, pursuing peace, loving God's creatures and drawing them close to Torah. So the fact that he's a sinner, but it's because he doesn't know. And therefore, the way that we approach that is the teaching of Pirkei Avos, be like Aharon HaKohen, love everyone, pursue peace, and it's only through love that you'll bring them back to Torah. Those who are far from God's Torah must be drawn close with strong bonds of love. Thus, the mitzvot to love and to hate coexist. It is a mitzvah to hate the evil that exists within a person, while loving the hidden spark of godliness that resides within him. And this is what, in most of our interactions with people out there in the world, this is what we have. We have aspects of sinfulness. We have that in ourselves also, just in case you didn't think so. We certainly have that as well. We have aspects of godliness. And there's a mitzvah to love every aspect of godliness, even as we reject the aspect of sinfulness. And what I am saying, I am acknowledging, is not politically correct in the day and age that we live in which, in the American society in which we live, we love everyone, and for all that they stand for, and do whatever you want, it's all good, just let me do what I want to do, and I'll let you do what you want to do. And there is that's the society we live in. There are things which are objectively right and objectively wrong. There are things which are moral and things which are immoral. And it's our obligation to fulfill this last passage, which is extremely difficult and sophisticated, and to say, I love the godliness in you. I love the aspects in you of that godliness. And there are aspects, there are behaviors which are sinful. And this is not something you say to a person. This is just something for us to understand. There are things which are wrong. There are things which are immoral. And it doesn't define a person. Just we all, within ourselves, we have things which are wrong and are immoral that we all do. All the time. It's part of the human condition. We all have it. And everybody, the task is to love every Jew, to see the godliness in every Jew, and to know that it's only through loving them that there's a chance to bring them close And to know that there are parts which even though I accept a person, there are certain aspects which are not okay. Now, what that means in practice, that doesn't mean, you don't have to be the one to rebuke them if it's not your place, and you don't have to be the one to yell at them, and you don't have to, it doesn't mean all that. But it just means that we understand that there are things which are okay and things which are not okay, and they are important, and it matters. And as a whole, we love the person, and we love the godliness that are within them. And that is not necessarily the culture in which we live, but so it goes. Okay. So we move to anger. A few minutes, we'll talk about controlling anger a little bit. So it would be really easy if we never got angry at anybody, then we'd be able to love them and all aspects of that, except that people actually get us angry. They do things to us which draw our ire all the time. So Chazal, our sages, have many, many nasty, negative things to say about people who get angry. It's a completely destructive thing. But just as an introduction to how we need to sort of view this, Rav Zelig Plotkin, who wrote a book on anger, on controlling anger, see, he opens with the story of a person who was taken to court and charged of a crime that he knows he didn't do. There was some mistake, but it's a pretty serious crime, and he's waiting. Waiting in the room right outside the courtroom for his turn at trial, and as he's sitting there, there's a child, I don't know, maybe 7, 8 years old, running up and down the hallway, just running, making noise, irritating all the people there that are waiting. It's really inappropriate. I mean, this is a serious thing. He's on trial for a serious crime. His life is at stake, and there's this child who is totally disruptive, disrespectful, running into the works. And right before he says something to the child, he notices, as he sees the child's face, the child bears a striking resemblance to his judge. And it suddenly occurs to him that his judge had brought his child to work that day. And while the judge is in his room, this child is running amok in the hallway. And then he thinks twice about what he was going to say to the child. And he realizes, I'm going to have to stand in front of this judge in the next couple of minutes. I got this child running around. And whereas he'd wanted to say something pretty nasty and really rip into this child, he decided instead to say something along the lines of, I think, a child of your stature can be behaving, far more appropriate than the way that you are. Or something in that, because he probably didn't say anything at all. So Zelman Plotkin writes, that person on trial, that's us. After 120 years, we're going to go up to the heavenly throne, and we're going to be judged. And the king, sitting on his throne, sent us lots of little children running around in our way throughout our lives. We thought we were here to accomplish whatever it was, and there's always this annoying little kid like this, out of his way, this little kid. And we have an opportunity how we're going to interact with them. Now, the kids who are getting in our way are actually 30, 40, 15, 60 years old. They're not necessarily children, but they're all God's children. And some of them are pretty irritating. Some of them are annoying. Some of them are inappropriate. Some of them don't know any better. Some of them do. But right after you interact with that child, you're going to have to stand in front of the judge. And he's going to look at you after you just spoke to one of his children. So how do you want to speak to that child before standing before that judge? That's how he introduces his book. Just a little framework for the reality. The left-hand, right-hand kind of parable is that same parable for all of us in this room and then outside of this room as well. Every Jew that we come to have an interaction with, be it from our closest children, spouse, parents, to colleagues, we are all Aravim Zebazah, we are all connected. Banim Atem Lashem Elkechem, we are all children of Hashem. And in the same way as I find here in the shul all the time, and I find in my own personal life, and certainly now in the yeshiva, in the school where I am, parents react to their children differently than like anything else on the planet. And if anyone starts up with their children, so you can't pretend. You cannot pretend that you're going to have a normal relationship parent to parent if parent to that parent's child you're nasty to. You do something nasty to that parent's child, so then your relationship, forget it, it's over. Say, what does that have to do with anything? I didn't do anything nasty to you. I just yelled at your child. Doesn't matter. You yell at my child, we're done. Yeah? Everyone know what I'm talking about? You ever experienced that before? Yeah, it's pretty simple. Right, that's how it goes. So Hashem says to us, these are my children. You are all my children. You got angry at them? I see this in the shul all the time. You know, what parent will come to me complaining that some parent yelled at this kid. How could you let this parent yell at my child? So you then speak to the offending parent. You say, why did he yell at that kid's child? At that parent's child. He said, well, he did X, Y, or Z. He was running in the hall. He threw a sitter. He spilled soda on my shoes, whatever it may be. Right? So the kid did something. But the parent of that child says, but how could you yell at my child like that? I mean, but the parent doesn't see anything else beyond that. That's it. So Hashem says, you are my children. You are my children. You're going to come up here after 120 years and you're going to sit in judgment. And if you think that I'm not going to take into account the way you yelled at my child, I will do that just like it happened to you down there in that world you just left. You yell at someone's child, your relationship with the parent is affected. All my children. All my children. The Gemara refers to anger. And I refer to yelling at children because the only reason why people yell at children is because they get angry. Why do they get angry? Because children deserve to be gotten angry at. But the question is how we handle ourselves when we do that. The Gemara says, look on page 3, and the pages start again because we went to a second series, but on page 3, towards the back side of your page, Pasuk from Ecclesiastes, from Kohelet, be not hasty in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the laps of fools. The Gemara goes so far as to say that any man who becomes enraged, if he is wise, he loses his wisdom. And if he is a prophet, he loses his prophecy. Why should it be that you lose your wisdom when you get angry? Can't think straight. It's so easy to answer that question here where you're sitting here and you're not angry at anybody. But when you're in the moment and you're angry at somebody, note, when you feel that blood pressure rising, you can't think straight. And when you can't think straight, generally the decisions you make are good or bad. They're generally pretty bad because you can't think straight. And you can't think straight when you are angry. In the words of the Rambam, Maimonides, in the bottom of page 3, those who frequently become angry have no quality of life. Such a strong language. In Hebrew, Balei Hakas Ein Chayehem Chayim. Their lives are not lives. You can't live when you're in a state of perpetual anger. Therefore, the sages instructed us to distance ourselves from anger to the farthest degree until a person acts as though he does not sense even those things that would justifiably anger a person. The sages push us beyond. Even when it's justifiable, don't get angry. Ein chayehem chayim. And I probably don't have to remind you that you all have people in your circles of life, be it at work, be it an extended family, maybe it's even in your nuclear family. People who are perpetually angry, you can say on them, Ein Chayehem Chayim. Their life is not a life. It's not a way to live. Constantly in a state of anger that this is wrong and that person did this and this thing has to be fixed. You can't live. There's no quality of life for a person who is constantly angry. The Gemara even goes so far as to say, on the bottom of page 7, on your next page, but at the bottom of page 7, the Gemara in Shabbos says, a person who tears his clothing in anger gets so angry that he rips something, he breaks a plate in his anger, breaks his possessions or scatters his money in rage, is considered as though he worships idols. An idolater. Why, says the Gemara? Because the Pasuk says, Lo yevcha el zar. You shouldn't have within you, literally in you, don't have amongst you foreign gods. And the Gemara says, what kind of foreign god would be literally that would say is in you? The person has this inclination from within himself, this sense of self, self-righteousness, that if you get so angry that you rip something, you ruin your possessions, you throw away your money, you're worshipping yourself. You're worshipping yourself to such an extent that how could someone do this to me? You're idolatrous. Because we don't worship ourselves, we worship God. And a person who can get so angry has lost that completely. Lost that perspective as to where he is in life, what he needs to be accomplishing, what his goals are, and has put himself front and center, so that the Gemara literally puts on him the stamp of an idolater. So how do you control anger? So I'm not going to pretend the next 3 minutes to teach you that lesson, because I haven't yet mastered it myself, not even close. And we're running out of time, so I'm just going to share with you one or two little things. You can take these home and read them through. Shlomo, the Ramban, Nachmanides wrote a letter to his children. Ramban always wanted to move to Eretz Yisrael. When he was older, he moved to Eretz Yisrael, and he wrote a letter back to his sons in Spain. And he opens up his letter as follows. It's on the bottom of page 12. Tisnaheg tamid ledover kol dvorecha benachas. Accustom yourself to speak gently to all people at all times. This will protect you from anger, a most serious character flaw which causes one to sin. His language is very, very strong. He uses the word kol, all, three different times in this phrase. Accustom yourself to speak gently at all times to all people. All your words at all times to all people. Because if I could tell you should speak gently, so you'd say, of course I should speak gently. When should I speak gently? All the time. Except when? Except to that guy. That guy, when he does that thing, he needs to be yelled at. So Ramban says, I know that guy. And I know that circumstance. And I know that conversation. Accustom yourself to speak gently to all people at all times. And if all your words are spoken gently, there is no greater tool to avoid anger than speaking gently. And it's like easy to say, very hard to do. But if you don't even think about it, you'll never do it. But if you watch the tension in a room as those tensions are rising, and as the anger is flaring up, there's something which always comes along with it. And that's the decibel level of the speakers. It's louder and more abrasive. And that's where, when those situations are happening, we feel it within ourselves. You lose it. You begin to lose that control, lose that sense of calm, lose the sense of serenity. Speak gently always. And if you can't speak gently because the emotions don't allow for it, don't speak. Time out, pause, move away, re-engage in a few minutes. Because if you're not speaking gently, then you are speaking harshly. And when you're speaking harshly, anger is either already there or soon to follow, and nothing productive happens when you're not thinking rationally. And when you are angry, you are not thinking rationally. Those are the words of the Ramban. Always, always, always speak gently. Rav Shlomo Volbil passed away 8-9 years ago. He was one of the leading Torah thinkers in the land of Israel, of our generation. Used to have a group of guys that he would work with, and he writes in number 13, the traits, and with this thought I will conclude. He's basing himself on a Rashi, so I'll take one step back. Who was the greatest, humblest of all men that ever lived? Moshe. Rashi defines what made Moshe a humble person. Where does his humility come from? So Rashi said he was a savlon. He had patience. Patience, in the Hebrew word savlon, literally means to be able to tolerate. He was able to tolerate. And if there's one trait that needs to be developed to be able to avoid anger, to be able to speak gently, it's a combination of those two English words, which is in one big Hebrew word, patience and tolerance. I'm able to tolerate things, people, ideas, words that I don't like, and I'm able to be patient, not to have to respond immediately, not to have to be able to deal with it immediately. I can wait. I can deal with it. I have the patience to allow it to settle, to figure it out, to think, to see what we can change. Patience, tolerance. Patience, tolerance. Moshe was a savlon. He was able to be sovil. He was able to tolerate. He was able to manage. And when you talk about anger, generally people who get angry, or at times when we get angry, we don't have patience and we don't have tolerance. So I didn't do it justice. I'm not even going to pretend like I did. But three things to take away as far as the anger goes. If you take these three things, you'll be able to fulfill v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, loving your friend. Speak gently, patience, tolerance. And with those three, we can fulfill in caring about everybody else, loving them, wanting for them what it is that we want for ourselves. And with that, we'll be the people that God desires for us. Have a fabulous evening.